From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it's day three of the impeachment trial of President Trump. Democratic House managers, the prosecutors, will continue to lay out their case today that the president abused the power of his office by pressuring the president of Ukraine to conduct an investigation that would benefit the president politically, then obstructing Congress in their attempt to investigate that. The president tweeted Thursday that the Democratic case against him is loaded with lies and misrepresentations and called his impeachment trial the most unfair and corrupt hearing in congressional history. Ayesha Rascoe, White House reporter for NPR, is here. And Ayesha, yesterday Adam Schiff's opening statement went on for more than 2 hours. Democrats saying President Trump, as we know, withheld this military aid, tried to get an investigation into the Bidens. For those supporting a conviction after this trial, there seemed to be overwhelming detail pointing to that. But Republicans are saying there was nothing new. Was there anything new?
There wasn't anything new. At this point, the Senate voted against allowing any new witnesses or evidence at this point. So what the House impeachment managers have been presenting is the information that the House gathered. But some Republicans that seems to be a talking point among Republicans, is that they're saying they're not hearing anything new, that the Democrats are just repeating these arguments that they've heard for a long time. It's not clear, though, because of the fact that they aren't allowing new witnesses right. or new information, where you would get something new in this case. But what the House managers do seem to be trying to do is just lay out in detail the timeline of events that led to impeachment, and they're focusing, drilling down on certain aspects of the case. And they're also just talking broadly about the implications of impeachment and why they argue that this is about the future of the country and checks and balances on the executive branch.
Well, you mentioned witnesses. Yesterday, former Vice President Joe Biden said he would not be part of a witness swap. Republicans would call him or his son Hunter in exchange for testimony by these top Trump administration officials who were in the room when things happened. We spoke today with Representative Jim Jordan, the Republican of Ohio, and asked him about witnesses. Here's a bit of what he said.
I hope that there won't be witnesses called. But if you do, if you go down that road, if you start down the witness road, then you got to go all the way down it. You can't just say, the prosecution can call their witnesses, but the president can't call witnesses he might want. So if we're going to start down that road, I think you got to go all the way down it.
Well, and that, of course, implies meaning the Bidens. Ayesha, why wouldn't Democrats want Joe Biden called, for instance? World opinion at the time this all happened was that Joe Biden was actively rooting out a corrupt prosecutor because the prosecutor wasn't investigating enough. And it was noted at the time that Biden's son's job at a company did not look good, but wasn't impacting Biden's fight against corruption.
Well, what Democrats have said publicly is that they don't feel like Biden's testimony would be relevant. Their argument is that this is about President Trump and his decisions regarding Ukraine and his decisions to hold up aid. And that's what this is about. And that Biden couldn't speak to that, that this really isn't about what happened during the Obama administration. It's about what happened during the Trump administration. That said, it is true that if they are going to have witnesses at this trial, it seems like there's going to have to be some type of compromise, because they're not going to be able to get the support to do this without bringing over some Republicans.
Yeah. Representative Schiff closed his remarks last night by invoking former Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch and former National Security Council official Fiona Hill, two diplomats who were key witnesses in the inquiry. And we know the claim is that some of President Trump's supporters tried to force Yovanovitch out. Here's what Schiff said.
They risked everything, their careers. And yes, I know what you're asked to decide may risk yours too. But if they could show the courage, so can we.
Now, Ayesha Rascoe, I know you're working hours on end on this. You are not, you know, going to bars in D.C. after the impeachment. But do you have a sense if any of what the Democrats are saying is moving any Republicans?
From what we've heard publicly, it doesn't seem that it's really moving the needle for Republicans. Of course, there are some Republicans who may be holding their cards closer to their chest and not letting everyone know how they're feeling. There are Republicans who are taking notes and seem to be taking everything in. So we don't know at this point if minds have really been changed. From what we've heard, it doesn't sound like it, but some people may be wanting to wait until they hear the entire case.
And of course, they're speaking to both the Republicans there in the Senate gallery and to voters in the next election. You know, we don't yet know if there's been any impact there.
We don't know. I mean, before this came out, before the trial started, we've had a lot of polls that have shown that the country is really divided on what should happen here. And as with many issues right now, but that a majority of Americans do think that the president did something wrong. They may not agree that he deserves to be removed. And also that a majority of Americans did think that there should be more witnesses allowed and more evidence allowed at this trial.
Aisha Roscoe, White House reporter for NPR. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, while the impeachment trial hinges on whether the president invited foreign election interference, officials are on the lookout for upcoming threats to this year's elections and are beefing up defenses across federal and state levels to prepare. NPR election security editor Phil Ewing joins us now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jeremy.
So we've talked to you many times about how Russians interfered in the 2016 race, but officials now say others could get involved in 2020. Shelby Pearson is the intelligence community's election threats executive. She spoke to Morning Edition about the range of threats she's expecting this year.
This isn't a Russia-only problem. We're still also concerned about China, Iran, non-state actors, hacktivists, and frankly, certainly for DHS and FBI, even Americans that might be looking to undermine confidence in the elections.
Why so many more threats this time around?
Well, one reason we've heard from her and officials like her is that there's a playbook to do this now. There's a template that's been established by the Russian government against the West and the United States in 2016. And also there's an investigation, an extensive investigation produced by the United States government itself about roughly what took place then, what kind of inlets these influence mongers were able to use to get into American networks, how they used Bitcoin and other technical means to try to not only cause disruptions within the United States, but also launch cyber attacks against a lot of targets around the country. And so for other players in the cyberspace, be they nation state actors, as we heard Pearson talk about, or even people acting on their own, there's kind of a path that you can follow now.
When it comes to the kinds of threats, are people expecting countries to do what Russia did in 2016 and try to sow misinformation to affect the outcome of the election? Or could there actually be attempts to tamper with votes?
The answer appears to be all of the above. And one concern is the degree to which the 2016 template or model I was talking about a moment ago was just a trial run for something more sophisticated that people at the local level, the state level, or the federal level might not be on the lookout for in the same way. One challenge with doing security of any kind, national security or otherwise, is the old idea that the generals are always fighting the last war. And on the one hand, there's a great deal more attention and sensitivity to these issues now than before. This is something that's getting an unprecedented level of attention from us who are covering it, from officials like Shelby Pearson, who we heard from on NPR, and others. But at the same time, you don't know what you don't know. And that uncertainty has definitely come through in all the coverage that we and our correspondents here have done.
Well, it's one thing to cover it and raise awareness of it, but what are federal and state level officials actually doing about it?
One thing they have told us they're doing is they're working together much more than they ever did. In fact, our colleague Pam Fessler had a great story this week about an election official in Texas who got a phone call from someone asking some very sensitive questions about election security procedures and cyber procedures in her county there. And her alarm bells immediately went off. And as it turned out, this person who called had been hired to do red teaming or testing of their election security defenses, and the system worked. These election officials, in this case in Texas, were on their guard. They were prepared for people to ask them questions that they shouldn't be answering because it might reveal their practices or their passwords, for example. And if you scale up from that example to the whole nation, you have what we've heard from people like Pearson and the Department of Homeland Security and others is this comprehensive focus on doing these types of practices. The other thing that remains true today across the United States is there are many thousands of different jurisdictions across the country, from tiny counties in Texas and Hawaii to Los Angeles County with 10 million people. And so if you're trying to stuff the ballot box, as it were, there's no single and easy way to do that in all those places. That said, as we keep hearing and keep being reminded by officials and members of Congress, the perils here also may evolve, as I mentioned a moment ago. So it's definitely a race, as one person put it to our correspondents, without a finish line.
What do we know about how confident the American people are right now in the election process?
NPR, PBS, and Marist did a poll about that. And according to those results, on the one hand, there's a good level of confidence that elections will be safe and secure this year and that votes will be counted. But there are still many Americans, significant pluralities of Americans, who are concerned about that. 44% of respondents, said they're concerned about all the votes being counted properly. A third of respondents said in that poll that they worry about foreign tampering in the 2020 race. And about 40% of those surveyed said in that poll that the U.S. isn't prepared to safeguard the 2020 race. So for all the additional awareness, all the heightened attention this is getting, there still is concern that we're hearing about voters that the country, the feds, state and local officials may actually be ready to have the presidential race go off smoothly in the coming year.
Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
Here's some good news. Morning Edition from NPR News isn't just for morning people. Now you can hear every story from the start, weekdays 7 till 3. Listen on your schedule. Just say, Alexa, play Morning Edition.
And we are following day 3 of the president's impeachment trial in the Senate, something that a lot of people are monitoring on their smartphones. Smartphones have become integral to many of our lives, but according to the consulting firm Deloitte, most Americans say they are on them too much. Cal Newport has been calling on people to rethink phone use. He's the author of Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World. He's also associate professor of computer science at Georgetown University. I spoke with him last year when he made his case that many of us are addicted to our devices.
It's a different type of addiction that you would have with a substance. It's what a psychologist would call a moderate behavioral addiction, which means if you have it around, you're probably going to use it more than is healthy.
Has it always been like that since we've had smartphones, or do you think it's gotten to a level that it's much worse than before?
Well, it's definitely gotten worse. A big part of this is that the user experience of social media was re-engineered so that it would foster more compulsive use. So Facebook 10 years ago is an experience that's very different than Facebook today. 10 years ago, you're looking at your friends' profiles. Mm-hmm. Today, it's this unending stream of rich rewards, likes and tags and comments that are coming at you all day long that you have to keep compulsively checking.
You point out, actually, that they changed the color of the notification alert from blue to red because it sets off an alarm bell in your head. Oh, I've got to check something.
Yeah, the designer said, of course, this should be within our palette, so it should be blue. But the attention engineer said, you know, if it's alarm red, people are going to click more. More clicks is more user engagement minutes. More user engagement minutes is more revenue.
And what does that do to us, the user?
Well, the main complaint I've been hearing from people is the sense that they're losing autonomy, by which I mean this idea that they have to keep going to the phone more than they think is useful, more than they think is healthy, to the exclusion of things they know are more important, makes it feel like they're losing control over what they're doing with their time and what they're doing with their life.
What are we losing? What are we missing out because of that?
Well, we're missing out on many of the activities that historically we need to flourish as human beings. So something as simple as solitude, that is just time alone with your own thoughts to reflect and think about things that are important, or just simple real-world analog conversation where you could sit across from someone and see how their body language shifts. These basic activities, which is crucial to a flourishing, functional human life, we're omitting them as we spend more and more time just tending this digital stream.
And you point out that one of the reasons for that is because when we look at a new app, for example, we only think about the benefit. We don't think about the cost. And good old Henry David Thoreau would have said, think about the cost.
Exactly. Thoreau was a great minimalist, and he had this idea that if you just look at the benefits, you become a maximalist. So you're always just trying to maximize the number of these little benefits that you've accrued. But in doing that, you miss what are the cost, what do you actually have to pay to get these benefits. And in particular, he said, what is the cost in terms of your life energy, your life force, time you could be spending on something more important? So the maximalists think they're better off because they're hunting down all these small scraps of value. But what they're really missing out on is the great satisfaction that comes from taking that energy and consolidating it on the small number of things that you know for sure are really important to you.
Okay, so we've laid out the problem, and I bet a lot of our listeners are thinking to themselves right now, oh my God, what am I going to do about this? I'm addicted to my device. So let's shift focus here and talk about some of the solutions that you talk about in this book. And one of them is to give up everything for 30 days.
Yeah, start from scratch. Clear it all out. Step away for 30 days. Get back in touch with what you really care about, what you want to spend your time on. And then when you're done with the 30 days, rebuild that digital life from scratch, but do it this time with real intention.
That's got to be really hard to do, though, to give it all up for 30 days in this modern world.
It sounded hard to me. So when I put a call out to my readers to say, hey, who wants to do this experiment? I thought maybe 20 or 30 people would volunteer. Instead, 1,600 people signed up to spend the month of January 2018 without this technology. Mm-hmm. And that's what told me, yeah, it's hard, but the way that we're living now is even harder. People are hungry and ready for a change.
And you say that in the first couple of weeks, it was very hard. And then they kind of thought, maybe this is not such a bad thing.
One young woman told me that during the first week, she was so used to checking her phone for new information that after she took all of the apps off for this declutter, she found herself compulsively checking the weather app because it was the last thing that was left on there that you could click on and maybe get some new information. But after about 10 days, 14 days, that went away. And most people reported that by the time they got to the end of the 30 days, they had really lost their taste for having this low-quality, always-on digital stream being a part of their life.
Right. Well, there is a level of boredom that you would be afraid of. These days, when you're standing in line at the supermarket, you know, you can pull out your phone and get caught up on what's happened, but you wouldn't be doing that in the world that you're describing.
Boredom is really important in my world. I mean, having on a regular basis time where it's just you alone with your thoughts, just observing what's going on, thinking about the random things that pop into your head. This might sound intolerable to the modern smartphone sort of infected individual, but it's absolutely crucial to resetting your mind, to having insights, to having successful self-reflection. And so boredom is good. Yeah, someone was telling me today about how they remembered fondly when you were at the bar waiting for your friend to get there. And the conversations you would have with just the random person next to you or talking to the bartender, there's just something social and connecting about that that we forget how those simple things really went a long way to humanizing the people around us.
And now we would just look down at our phone if we're sitting there at the bar waiting for somebody.
We all do. And what we don't recognize is how recent and arbitrary this is. This notion that a smartphone needs to be a constant companion. Something that you look at all day long like an air traffic controller, managing this influx of information and sending your missives out into the world. We're used to that. But to someone who was, let's say, going in a time machine from 7 years ago, would look at this and say, this is really unusual. What are you guys doing?
What about the idea that on a network like Facebook, we're able to stay in touch with hundreds of people that we've known in our lives and know when they have a baby or when they're going on vacation or whatever, and that we wouldn't be able to do that if we didn't have something like that?
I think that's okay. I think this notion that you need to know that someone that you met 25 years ago just had another kid, that this is somehow crucial to be social, it just doesn't match the history of human sociality.
What if somebody is listening and they think, I can't do 30 days without my device. Is there something less intense that I can do?
Well, there's two exercises you could do to essentially warm up for the big event, which is the 30-day break. And so the two exercises I recommend is, one, take off your phone any app in which someone makes money every time you click on it. You don't have to quit the services. You can still access them on your laptop or desktop. You just don't have them with you throughout the day. My second recommendation is start working on reintroducing the type of high-quality analog leisure activities that we used to fill our time with. So when the time comes to actually step away from technology and start from that blank slate and rebuild your digital life, you're not going to be staring into the abyss. You're going to know what you want to do with your time and be excited about it.
Well, you actually talk in this book about somebody who took a break from digital devices and managed to read, what, 6 books in a couple of weeks or 8 books in a couple of weeks?
A lot of people gave me a similar story. People kept sending me tallies, their book tallies. They were so proud, but they were also really happy about it because they forgot how satisfying that is to go deep on something as opposed to just skimming, swiping, and tapping.
You say some people actually go for the old-fashioned flip phone just to try to minimize the amount of time they spend on the phone.
This is becoming more popular. It's interesting. I've been reporting on this some. This is now a trend, this notion that you have a simple flip phone. There's some new ones that they're building which look really nice. You could text message on them. You could take phone calls, and that's it. And people are reporting back to me that when you cut off that digital stream that's constantly pulling at your attention and you're just there in the world, it's like you're living a completely different style of lifestyle. So I'm not surprised that this trend is starting to spread again.
Cal Newport, I'm going to make a prediction right now, which is that if we were to play this interview again in 2 years, we'd still be facing the exact same issues that you're talking about right now. Why is it so hard for us to fix this problem?
Well, I'm not sure if your prediction is going to come true because something I've noticed, and I've been writing and talking about this for years and years, is that there's something different in the air right now. I mean, people used to tell self-deprecating jokes about how much they use their phone, but when they would meet me and find out I didn't use social media, they would think I'm weird. This has really changed. Something's in the air. I think people are finally getting fed up with how much of their humanity they're losing to always staring at these screens. And so my more optimistic prediction is that we have become so tired of how enslaved we've become that we are going to revolt. And so if we came back 2 years from now, my hope is what we would be saying is, can you believe that we ever used to live that way?
Well, and one of the things that really makes you think in this book is you bring up people like Martin Luther King and the idea that solitude was actually very important to him being able to think some of his most important thoughts.
Well, this is one of the biggest unintended consequences of what we've engineered in this digital age is that it's made it possible to banish completely time alone with your own thoughts. Mm-hmm. This is a huge novelty in human history, and it's not good for us. And so, yeah, I do go back and retell the story of Martin Luther King's kitchen table conversion experience because for him, like for everyone, time alone with your thoughts is where real self-development, self-reflection, and progress is made. You have to put in those hours of just thinking about yourself, your life, and what you're all about if you want to get anywhere worth going.
Cal Newport, author of Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World. He's also Associate Professor of Computer Science at Georgetown University. We spoke last February. You can read an excerpt from his book at hereandnow.org, or you could just go outside, not use your device, not look at the computer screen at all.
And now in the category of you could not make this up, a report from the UN alleges that it was Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman who hacked Washington Post owner and Amazon founder Jeff Bezos' cell phone in May of 2018, 5 months before the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And a UN investigator joins those saying there is credible evidence the Crown Prince was behind that murder. Saudis deny it. Today, a White House spokesperson said the reports are being taken seriously. So why would the Saudis hack Jeff Bezos? Why were he and MBS on texting terms? Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Robin.
So we know Bezos had a private investigator, Gavin De Becker, who came to the same conclusion. You know, so many questions. Why would Saudis do a hack through a phone that was traceable, number one, to a crown prince? But also remind us, why Bezos?
Well, so Bezos and the crown prince met in 2018. On April 4th of that year, they were at a small dinner in L.A. They exchanged numbers and started texting each other on WhatsApp. And according to the investigation, after Bezos, you know, after it was declared that it was disclosed that he was having an affair, there was some speculation that the initial information, because stuff came out of his phone, came from the Saudis. But we didn't get the real sense of it until now. The allegation now is that Mohammed bin Salman sent Jeff Bezos a picture, and in doing so, it ended up sucking all this information out of Jeff Bezos' phone that was subsequently used against him to put pressure on, you know, to put some pressure on Jeff Bezos. This was before the Khashoggi killing. Right. This was because Jeff Bezos is the owner of the Washington Post, which published Jamal Khashoggi's material, which was critical of the Saudi administration.
And you mentioned the stuff from his phone, pictures, intimate information showing he was having an affair. Made its way to the National Enquirer, which is owned by American Media Inc., whose CEO is David Pecker, who was friends with the prince, but also, some say, was trying to get back in favor with Donald Trump.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us.
Because David Pecker was subsequently cooperating with federal investigators. He didn't seem to have much choice. They had a whole lot of evidence that he was involved in this catch and kill, where they would buy stories allegedly about Donald Trump's involvement with women and payoffs, and they would buy the story, the rights to the story, and not publish it. So investigators were now using David Pecker in their investigation of Donald Trump. Donald Trump was mad at David Pecker, so this was by some accounts, an effort by David Pecker to get back into Donald Trump's good graces.
With, it would seem, and this is speculation, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia whispering in his ear that he could do that with perhaps with this information. I mean, the UN is calling for further investigation. You mentioned catch and kill, which is the technique of taking us, buying a story and then not publishing it. But then there is a real catch and kill here.
Yes.
Of Khashoggi.
That's the intersection. And you're right, Robin, because if you went to an agent and said, I've got this novel for you, they'd say this is way too complicated and not likely to ever have happened. But the intersecting interests here, David Pecker and Donald Trump, embarrassing Jeff Bezos, whose paper publishes things that both the Trump administration doesn't like and the Saudi administration doesn't like, and then the idea that they were the home to Jamal Khashoggi, who, by the way, was not really that much of a Saudi critic.
Right.
It was just that he was an insider who was critical of the administration. So the idea that this all came together, that Jamal Khashoggi had information, knew how to get it out, that's why the United Nations is involved. Does this bring that whole issue of killing Jamal Khashoggi into the same circle?
And who knew what when? We need to find out. Ali Velshi, thanks so much.
As the third day of the impeachment trial plays out in Washington, we're going to spend a few minutes now listening to some key moments from yesterday, in case you weren't able to listen to all 9 or so hours of it. The House impeachment managers used recorded testimony from witnesses, publicly released text messages, and more to make the case that the president should be removed from office. Representative Adam Schiff led with the argument that the president's abuse of power and obstruction of Congress represent a threat to democracy.
In unprecedented fashion, the president ordered the entire executive branch of the United States of America to categorically refuse and completely obstruct the House's impeachment investigation. Such a wholesale obstruction of congressional impeachment has never before occurred in our democracy. And it represents one of the most blatant efforts at a cover-up in history. If not remedied by his conviction in the Senate and removal from office, President Trump's abuse of his office and obstruction of Congress will permanently alter the balance of power among the branches of government, inviting future presidents to operate as if they are also beyond the reach of accountability, congressional oversight, and the law.
Schiff continued to push for more documents and witnesses, which the Democrats want and the Republicans have so far refused to allow. But Schiff also argued that the evidence collected by the House stands on its own.
The documents and testimony that we were able to collect paints an overwhelming and damning picture of the president's efforts to use the powers of his office to corruptly solicit foreign help in his reelection campaign and withhold official acts and military aid to compel that support.
Schiff honed in on 3 days in July that he says are at the heart of the president's efforts to withhold military aid in order to get Ukraine to announce investigations that he wanted. Those are investigations into the Bidens and a debunked conspiracy theory about Ukrainian meddling in the 2016 election.
On the 24th, Special Counsel Mueller testifies that Russia interfered in our 2016 election to assist the Trump campaign, which knew about the interference, welcomed it, and utilized it. That's the 24th. The 25th is the day of the call, when President Trump, believing he had escaped accountability for Russian meddling in the first election and his welcoming of it, asked the Ukrainian president to help him undermine the special counsel's conclusion and help him smear a political opponent, former Vice President Biden. And then the third day in a row in July, President Trump sought to ensure that Ukraine had received his request and understood it and would take the necessary steps to announce the investigations that he wanted. 3 days in July.
Schiff referring there to the July 26th call between President Trump and Ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland. Sondland had just met with the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, when he called the president. David Holmes, a State Department aide, testified that Trump asked Sondland if Zelensky would conduct the investigations, and Sondland replied yes. We also heard yesterday from another House impeachment manager, Democrat Gerald Nadler, who said the president's efforts began with the ousting of former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch.
Why was this respected career diplomat abruptly removed from her post? Why was she, in fact, urged by the State Department to catch the first plane home, that she was in danger, she shouldn't wait? At the time, the White House would not say. But today, we know the truth. The truth is that Ambassador Yovanovitch was the victim of a smear campaign organized by Rudy Giuliani, amplified by President Trump's allies, and designed to give President Trump the pretext he needed to recall her without warning.
Meanwhile, the July 25th call, where the president asked for a favor, came up again and again yesterday, including from Congressman Hakeem Jeffries.
The July 25th call warrants our close scrutiny. It presents significant and shocking evidence of President Trump's corrupt intent. The call lays bare the president's willingness to do whatever it takes to get what he wants, even if his behavior undermines the national security interests of the United States of America.
At the close of the day yesterday, Chief Justice John Roberts announced that senators would be given access to one page of supplemental testimony, that is classified testimony, from Jennifer Williams, an aide to Vice President Mike Pence. Senators can view it in a secure setting. The Democrats continue to make their case today and will continue tomorrow before the president's defense team responds.
To the New Hampshire presidential primary, now less than 3 weeks away, a new poll by member station WBUR suggests Bernie Sanders might be peaking at just the right time. The survey of likely Democratic primary voters finds the Vermont senator in the lead, running well ahead of his three closest competitors, Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, and Elizabeth Warren. And as President Trump faces the impeachment trial this week, the poll also found that big majorities of New Hampshire voters believe Trump should be removed from office. WBUR's Anthony Brooks reports.
This has been a good period for Sanders, who's been raising more money than anyone else in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. Two national polls this week found Sanders and Biden ahead, while a number of other polls have Sanders close to or in the lead in Iowa and New Hampshire. The new WBUR poll is the latest. It finds that Sanders is the choice of 29% of likely Democratic primary voters. That's well ahead of Buttigieg, who led our last poll in December, but who's now in second place with 17%. Biden with 14% and Warren with 13% are virtually tied in third place. Steve Cozzella, president of the Mass Inc. polling group, conducted the poll. He cautions that with almost 3 weeks to go until the primary, much can change.
So I wouldn't take these numbers to the bank, but you got to be feeling pretty good about where you stand right at this moment if you're the Sanders campaign.
The 78-year-old Sanders does particularly well with younger voters, according to the WBUR poll. He has the support of 52% of Democratic voters under 30. That includes 29-year-old Elizabeth Ahern, an independent from Tuftonboro, New Hampshire, who says she's backing Sanders because he's pushing for Medicare for all.
I have a cranial mass. I have a variety of other significant health issues, and everything's expensive. So it would be wonderful if we could have health care for all.
While the WBUR poll is the latest evidence of a Sanders surge, it also shows that overall support for Warren has stalled. Again, pollster Steve Cozzella.
It's not really that voters have turned on her. It's just that she hasn't attracted more support over the last 4 or 6 weeks or so.
In a WBUR poll last month, Warren had 12%. In this poll, she's up by just 1 point. The poll also found Joe Biden getting the most support from older voters, leading with folks over 60. Edward Barton, a 70-year-old independent from Belmont, New Hampshire, told us he's backing Biden because of his experience.
We need somebody in there that's got some common sense. He knows all the leaders and everything from being vice president, and that's what we need in there right now, especially now after the mess that Trump's making.
According to the poll, Barton speaks for a large majority of likely Democratic primary voters who favor impeachment of the president and his removal from office.
Yes, 100%. They should go in there with handcuffs and take him out in handcuffs.
The poll also found big majorities of respondents say Trump has made the U.S. less safe and oppose a number of administration policies and actions, including the assassination of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. It's not surprising that Democratic primary voters respond this way, but the poll found some significant nuance in these numbers. For example, while 93% say they have a negative view of Trump, a third of male Democratic primary voters say they approve of the way he's managed the economy. Pollster Steve Cozzella says these voters represent a significant opportunity for President Trump's bid to win re-election later this year.
So any inroads that they can make among the Democratic base, among older voters, older male voters on the economy, could be potentially very consequential.
New Hampshire, after all, is a swing state that Hillary Clinton won in 2016 by very few votes. No doubt it will be a battleground this year as well. For Here and Now, I'm Anthony Brooks.
And let's take a break from impeachment and spend a few minutes on sports, starting with the 2020 Baseball Hall of Fame class, which was announced this week. And former New York Yankees shortstop Derek Jeter was elected in his first year of eligibility. Here's his reaction.
Everyone told me it was a foregone conclusion. I didn't buy it, so it was not a relaxing day. There was a lot of anxiety. I was nervous.
Mike Pesca is Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Well, I guess he shouldn't have been nervous about that.
Yeah, he really shouldn't have been. I mean, Derek Jeter, I guess, is a guy who doesn't believe in stats because he deserved to get in. I just liken it to a lot of people are nervous before their wedding days. I suppose some percentage of grooms and brides are jilted at the altar, but this was a foregone conclusion. But what that quote shows you is that Derek Jeter is always saying the right thing. You don't want to say, oh, yeah, I assume this would happen. And you don't want to say, I take it for granted. So that's one reason. Mostly it's the on-field prowess. But him just being such a perfect embodiment of what you want a baseball player to be, that's another main reason why he got into the Hall of Fame so easily.
You think this is like a scientist waiting to find out about the Nobel Prizes at 5 a.m. or the Oscar nominees waiting to find out if they've been nominated?
Yeah, maybe with some Oscar nominees. I'm trying to think of, is there a scientist that, you know, Linus Pauling or someone, Watson and Crick, someone who so clearly deserves it. But I can't think of the equivalent to Derek Jeter, who was obviously going to get in on the first ballot. And the only question was, would he get in unanimously? And the answer is he did not, mostly because there are so many voters and one just has to say, I don't like to be like everyone else. And therefore, Derek Jeter, for some reason, doesn't get in unanimously.
Okay, well, Jeter is sharing the spotlight today in New York, at least, with another of the city's sports icons. New York Giants quarterback Eli Manning is retiring after 16 years. What do you make of that news, and what will his legacy be?
I'll answer that, but first I just want to say Larry Walker, because he also got in the Hall of Fame,
right.
And I don't want to Michael Collins him.
Took
you know,
him 10 years to get in.
That's right. So he's a Hall of Fame baseball player, noted. Eli Manning, and also by saying Larry Walker, I don't want to make this all New York-centric sports, but let's do it. Eli Manning is retiring. Cynics might say he should have retired a couple years ago. He won two Super Bowls, and in those seasons, he was great. And in almost every other season, he was mediocre to beyond mediocre. He'll be an interesting test case as to will he get into the Hall of Fame. I predict probably, because if you win two Super Bowls and if you have the last name Manning, a Hall of Fame is probably in the offing.
Mike, let's talk about basketball. I know you were watching last night when rookie Zion Williamson made his NBA debut for the New Orleans Pelicans. He was the top draft choice, but he has been injured. What did you see last night?
Yeah, so more every year there's a top draft choice, but I would say this is as highly an anticipated player to come into the NBA in a decade. First quarter, he plays 4 minutes, does almost nothing. Second quarter, plays 4 minutes, does almost nothing. He, like, gets an assist of maybe 2 points. Third quarter, plays 3.5 minutes. So I'm sitting there knowing I'm going to talk to you today and saying, how do I be kind about this? I could caveat it and say, well, you know, it's his first game and we're all a little rusty and let's not expect too much. But then he goes in for the fourth quarter and he hits a three-pointer and he hits a three-pointer. And I'm saying to myself, maybe they should guard him. And he hits a three-pointer and he converts an alley-oop and he hits a three-pointer and he goes crazy in 3.5 minutes. And it is a thrilling debut, and fascinatingly, the Alvin Gentry, the coach of the Pelicans, takes him out of the game. They went from 10 points down to a lead, take Zion out, and of course the Pelicans blow the lead because, you know, Zion's the franchise now after playing 13 minutes or so of NBA basketball.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Mike, and that is college basketball. Earlier this week, there was this really ugly incident at the end of the Kansas-Kansas State game when a fight broke out. Here's how the announcers reacted on ESPN.
That's not good.
This is bad. No good. Oh, this is terrible.
Well, you can tell there that it was bad and terrible
and no good. No good.
Ugly. What do you think about what you saw there?
Professional announcers, thank God we have them. Yes. This was a fight that spilled into the stands between Kansas and Kansas State. It was one of these blowout games where a Kansas State player didn't just allow the clock to be dribbled out. He tried pretty foolishly and unsportsmanlike, tried to steal the ball. But then a player on Kansas during the brawl picks up a chair or stool over his head. So, yeah, it's rough. But, you know, I would say tempers flare and suspensions are being given out. Afterwards, in the studio show, ESPN was talking about criminal charges for some of these guys. Come on. It is a basketball game. No one got seriously hurt. Mm-hmm. It's ugly. Agreed. Stipulated. No good. Very bad. Let's pull back and take a breath.
Super Bowl prediction, Mike? 49ers, Chiefs?
You know, weirdly, I think the 49ers are going to win. But that's just me. I would say that everyone looks at what Kansas City has done offensively, and usually the better offensive team, people talk themselves into them being unstoppable. But to me, San Francisco, I think on both sides of the ball, they're the better team. What do I know? I usually get these things wrong.
Mike Pesca, here now, sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
Should have asked him who's going to win the Iowa caucuses.
But he usually gets these things.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.